Good evening. Hi, everyone. My name's Kathy English. I am vice chair of the Canadian Journalism Foundation and also the public editor of the Toronto Star. The issues we're going to talk about tonight are very near and dear to me. I'm really happy to welcome you to tonight's event, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But first of all, I'd like to acknowledge and thank our very generous sponsors, TD, for sponsoring this event. I want to acknowledge this beautiful, beautiful space, but most of all, for the last, I think, 5 years, TD has welcomed us to an event built around International Women's Day. And what we really want to thank them for is the commitment to the issues that matter to journalism and that matter to all Canadians. I also want to acknowledge the amazing new support of TD for a program to bring students and aspiring journalists to our programming. Do we have any students here? Yay, welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Thanks also to the in-kind support of Cision. So tonight's discussion is a really vital one as we think about who the media represents and who is left out. What is the journalism that reflects the communities we want to serve? So before I introduce you to our moderator, I want you to consider some words that come from what I think is just an outstanding report that I think one of our panelists will be able to talk to tonight. It's called Reflect Reality, and it looks at the global efforts to bring more diverse voices to journalism. So these words really spoke to me. Imagine for a moment that women experts were fully represented in all media. Women and girls would be empowered and emboldened to fully participate in society, adding untold talent, skills, and wisdom to a world that desperately needs them. Culture would shift and adapt as stereotypes were smashed, and the news and information we all consume would be inclusive of diverse voices, rebuilding trust in the critical resource of reputable media. That quote asks us to imagine. I say tonight we continue the work of making this happen. So we have a very distinguished panel, but first I have the honor of introducing our moderator, Supriya Dwivedi. Supriya is the host of the morning show on Global News.
Hi.
Global News Radio 640, Toronto, and a regular panelist on CBC's Power and Politics. Also a lawyer, she's previously worked in government relations and strategic communications, as well as advising political campaigns. Supriya is fluently trilingual in English, French, and Hindi, so she can direct this panel in all three languages. Thank you, Supriya.
Thank you. I'll just sit here. Everybody can hear me properly, right? My mic's on. All right. Let's start going this way. Sherry Graydon. Sherry is the founder and catalyst of Informed Opinions. She's also an award-winning author, as well as a women's advocate. Her newest book, OMG, What If I Really Am the Best Person, is part of her grand plan to bridge the gender gap in public discourse by 2025, and to make Canada more democratic. Deborah Ensor is currently the Senior Vice President of Technical Leadership at Internews. Internews is an international nonprofit that works in more than 70 countries around the world to build healthy information environments that enable everyone to make better informed decisions, bridge divides, participate more fully in their communities, as well as holding power to account. As part of her current role, Deborah leads the United for News work around increasing women's expert voices in the media. Melissa Stasiuk, is head of programming at the Globe and Mail, which means she leads a team of 15 journalists who identify priority stories for the widest or most appropriate audience. She's also on the hiring committee for the Globe Summer Program, which hires students or recent grads, and led the Breaking the Habit 2.0 initiative, which was aimed at increasing female voices in Globe stories, in partnership with United for News. She can also teach you baby sign language. Evelyn, aka Evie, Kwong, is a social media and audience lead at the Toronto Star. When she's not scouring the internet for the latest trending events and memes, she's working on shaping the voice of the Star's social platforms, from Twitter to Facebook to Instagram, and thinking of new social strategies to gain new audiences. She also writes a weekly social media column for the Star and started the business column Millennial Money Series in hopes of engaging a more vast audience. Without further ado, let me just, as a true millennial, I have all the questions on my phone. So Sherry, let me actually start with you. I want to kick this off because you and I, we had a couple of conference calls in the lead up to this, and it's something that I know you've talked about quite a lot in this particular aspect. There's this sort of prevailing sense out there that if you're trying to get more diverse voices, or if you're trying to get more female voices into the mix, then all of a sudden you are somehow sacrificing that by not getting the best voice. And that seems to be one of the main impediments that, at least anecdotally, I tend to hear from time to time. So, I mean, how do you get over that notion?
Well, I guess the bottom line is if we need to stop pretending that we live in a pure meritocracy, first of all. Because if we did, the world would look different than it does.
Elizabeth Warren would still be in the race.
Yeah. Donald Trump would not be president. Yeah. We won't go there. But I would say that what we've heard from journalists who have actively reached out and diversified their sources is that they get richer, more interesting stories. And the notion that there ever is one best person is bullshit. Because we know that given that we all come to every issue with our own set of priorities and experiences and perceptions, we're going to have different views on the subject. And so, I understand, I hear that, and I know that journalists work hard to get the best person possible for their story. And I just think we need to blow up the notion that there is that one best person. And my tongue-in-cheek book title, Oh My God, What If I Really Am the Best Person, is a play on that, that you know, there is no such thing as the best person, and anybody who has the reason we called informed opinions is because there are many informed opinions on any particular issue, and if you're serving a diverse audience like the one in this room, you want to be reflecting their perspectives and realities, and the way to do that is to have diverse sources.
Deborah, you have a very international background. You have a lot of experience with what the world of journalism is really like. How does Canada stack up? How do we compare globally in terms of the female voices that we cite and how, you know, our journalism would really reflect, I guess, our gen pop?
Right. It's a great question to think about how you can compare across different regions in the world. There's an organization called the Global Media Monitoring Project, which is actually based in Toronto. They do the longest running longitudinal study of women's voices in the news. It started in 1995, and they do it every 5 years. They pick a random day, and they have volunteers all over the world in over 120 countries that actually count the number of women that appear, not only as not only just appearing in the news, but in terms of the topics that they talk about, in terms of the actual person they are. Are they an expert commentator? Are they a witness, a bystander? Is it their personal opinion? And the statistics from 2015, which was when the last one was done, the current one is going to be done this year in 2020, back to 1995. In 1995, it was 17%.
Wow.
In 2015, it was 24%, 7% increase over 20 years. At that rate, it will take us three quarters of a century to reach parity.
Which, that's not good.
Not very good.
2025, people, 2025.
So it's a little hard to compare country by country. I don't know if, Sherry, you have more statistics, but pretty much North America does better.
Okay.
But the global statistic is pretty accurate to almost everywhere.
Sherry, that was a very enthusiastic head nod.
28.
So. Okay.
So you know, there are different ways of measuring different things, but we have a gender gap tracker. It's an online digital analytics tool that measures in real time the ratio of male to female sources in Canada's 7 most influential news platforms. We're only measuring text, not video or audio, and sports absolutely skews the data in a significant way, and who's elected as a political official, a minister, they're quoted much more often. So, you know, there are some predictable defaults that you can't get around, but the data in Canada is about 28%.
Yeah.
Melissa, you're part of the hiring committee in terms of the Globe and who they're getting onto their summer program. I was just wondering from your perspective, in dealing with recent journalism grads, are you optimistic for the future? Or is it one of those things where it's like, oh, I don't know if this is going to get any better with the next gen of journalists? Because I would like to think that this is an us problem and not an up-and-coming problem.
Mm-hmm. I am optimistic. One of my favorite things to do at the Globe actually is the summer program, because we get so many passionate applicants, like year after year. I'm always, you know, so surprised by how many people still really want to be journalists. They know the challenges, and they know what the industry is like right now.
Yeah, they know the job placement right now.
They know that, you know, often at the end of the summer, we don't have full-time jobs for them, but they just so badly want to be in a newsroom. They so badly want to work with Globe and Mail journalists. That doesn't matter to them. So, I mean, that passion and drive and the need is always going to be there for journalists, I think. So that does make me optimistic, yeah.
Evie, you deal a lot with stories that engage well. You're, you know, social media and audience lead. How does it work? Like, so I'm just wondering if stories that quote only dudes, okay, to put it lightly.
Right.
Do they do better? Like, is there a reason, like, can editors hide behind metrics on this, or do the numbers not even play out?
I mean, look, I don't think that's true at all. As someone who counts, like, goes to the analytics, like, every single day, especially
on social. Kathy's
shaking
her head, so yeah.
So she knows, like, we work together, obviously. Yeah. So, no, I don't think so, and I honestly think that we don't need always, like, yes, we want analytics, yes, we want people to read the stuff, but I don't think that, like, we're talking about what the best person is, and to me, it's not doing your job if you don't represent the city. Like, we have over 50% visible minorities, and again, with women as well, like, there's layers that go with that too, right? So there's this, like, intersectionality for me is a huge thing that all the audiences that I want to hit is someone that I haven't seen in the paper very often. Growing up, for me, like, I had to say that I didn't really feel like I had a source, or what, I didn't know what my newspaper was, or I didn't know any of that, because I didn't feel like it told the stories of, you know, people like that look like me, or people that look like my friends, and it's just because I just feel that it wasn't, and it still isn't, and like we're talking about all the numbers that we're talking about is like, it's still kind of the same. But for me, I think it's really important now, as someone who has that platform, and I'm really lucky to have it, and I feel honored. I feel like it's my duty to go out and really talk to people, and not just like Chinese people because I'm Chinese, but everyone out there who I see is out there. Like, all my friends are really diverse. We have a really diverse population. I just don't think there's a best person. If you're going back to the same person, we're just gonna listen to the same people all the time, and I don't think that's the best thing. Yeah.
One of our reporters, actually, Christine Dobby, in talking about how she diversifies her sources, she made that same comment. She said she was getting bored reading her own stories because it was the same voices over and over again. And so that led her down this path of like, okay, how do I reclassify what the best person means so that I'm excited to read my own stories again?
This is like sort of a free-for-all, but Deborah, I'll start with you and then anyone else can chime in. But one thing that occurred to me is that, and Melissa, you alluded to this, but journalists are constantly doing more with less, right? We have fewer resources, newsrooms are getting leaner. Are we not just then putting an extra burden on them by saying, not only do you have to write a story, not only do you have to file by a certain time, not only do you have to cover, you know, general politics and, let's say, music, let's just throw that in there, but you also have to be diversifying your sources. Is that not just an extra layer we're adding on to people?
I would argue it's the exact opposite. I mean, it's an existential crisis that we're in as journalists, and if we can't reflect the communities that we say we represent. I mean, when you go back to the statistics and you flop them the other way, 75% of the views that I'm exposed to come from men. And it's like, I don't want to read that every day, and readers don't want to read that. And women are actually, from an advertising perspective, lots of advertisers want to reach a female consumer. And so I think it's better for business even for us to do this. And it's also our jobs as journalists. I mean, my background is entirely as a journalist. And back in the 1950s, when the International Journalism Foundation made their code of conduct, it states very clearly in 1950s that journalists are not supposed to perpetuate discrimination. And it's our job, actually, to ensure we don't do that. And so I don't buy this whole thing. It's like, we don't have time, we don't have time. It's part and parcel of what you take on as a journalist, is to represent your communities. And it's like saying, I don't feel like, you know, going and covering the accident that just happened.
Yeah. You know. So that's amazing to me, just in terms of, you know, the 1950s that's been out there, because that's very comparable to how long the US Surgeon General's warning has been there for smoking. And yet everyone here probably knows that smoking isn't good for you, right?
Yeah.
And yet we are still, you know, the stats that you cited off the top in terms of where we lag by citing female voices, that's just, it's really staggering. Yeah.
The Canadian Broadcasting Act also, which was, somebody in broadcasting might know this, I don't know, 1950, comparable era,
right,
explicitly says that the airwaves are a public utility. They're there for the benefit of all Canadians, men and women, and, you know, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. So public broadcasters, perhaps more familiar with that, take that seriously, as they should. But yeah, it's an imperative. And in terms of the audience engagement and the financial piece, the Financial Times, in fact, a year or so ago, they were attempting to make one of their regular newsletters that went out to their subscribers more appealing to female readers. And so they tweaked the newsletter. They probably included more female perspectives. And what they discovered was that the readership went up among male readers as well. Mm. And so the notion that we need to include women or diverse audiences only so that women and diverse audiences will engage with our journalism is narrow, because in fact the journalism becomes better, the stories become richer and more interesting, to your point.
Yeah, it's like not charity, like that you go out and talk about these people and find these people, and it's, oh, so hard to find these people. I don't want to read the same person over and over again. I know a lot of people, a lot of women don't want to read the same people over and over again, and also a lot of diverse people. Like, I don't need to read, if I wanted to read it, I could see years and years of that, right? But the city is changing, that's just the way it is. The population is like that, so I think for people, it is an extra step. It's just it's instead of thinking like, oh, it's so hard, or it's like a charitable thing, it's like actually enriching your own mind more, right? Like, you get to know the perspective of so many other people. And for me, since I've been able to do that, like on the audience team, I just feel like it's made me a better reporter, if anything.
Mm-hmm. I realize we got away from your question, which was
which
was the pressure on journalists to do more with less, and being on a 24-hour deadline. And so that's a reality. One of the reasons that Informed Opinion started a database of women was to make it easier for journalists to find diverse female sources across all disciplines. And Ed Yong, who some of you may be familiar with, he's the science writer for The Atlantic, he started a tracking spreadsheet off the side of his desk a few years ago because he wanted to notice how often he was quoting women. He discovered he wasn't doing nearly as well as he thought. Now he's at 50% and has been at 50-50, and he covers science, so that took effort. But he says that it takes him one extra hour a week. Now, he's not doing daily journalism, he's a magazine writer, but, you know, he's making the effort and he's tracking how much extra effort it takes. And the more you do it, the more sources you have that are diverse, then you're tapping into the networks of your diverse sources. So as a middle-aged white woman, my network looks, you know, more middle-aged white female than it does other diversities. But the more I expand it, then the greater opportunity I have to tap into the other networks of the people that I'm reaching out to.
And I think journalists see the reward. Like, when they see that their stories are either getting, you know, better promotion or a bigger audience,
right,
then it doesn't really feel like it's an extra task, because they can see that there's actually a payoff to it.
Deborah, I wanted to ask you, and then Sherry, feel free to chime in, but one of the things that I hear often on the broadcast side anyway, especially in radio, when it comes to getting newer voices or just voices that you haven't heard on air before, is you tend to, you know, producers tend to go back to the voices that they know, right? You want to go back to somebody who's A, familiar, who B, that you also know is engaging mm-hmm. and not going to be a dud on air, mm-hmm. particularly when it's live radio. Mm-hmm. So how do you get, you know, producers, journalists to get out of their bubble? Like, what do you think some of the impediments are that exist? Because it just occurs to me that in print, it doesn't really matter if you're boring because it's in print. That doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Like, you can be a dud on air, and like, there's a difference. So like, I'm just curious in terms of what you know, roadblocks that print journalists sort of run into.
There's a ton of strategies that journalists can use, and we put together this resource called Reflect Reality, which all of us here on the panel were a part of.
Fabulous resource.
We are actually launching it today for part of National Women's Day, and it has really a collection of so many people in the world that are talking and care about this issue. Talks about the problems, the challenges, but also a lot of solutions and strategies, and there's a whole section on strategies for journalists and how they can actually get out of their bubble and some of the things they can think about doing to find more interesting and diverse sources. Everything from using a database. We have a whole curated list of databases from all over the world, from different regions, different languages, different topics that is in this resource. You can make your own database, just take an hour a week, you know, that's part of your regular time. Go out and look for women. You can partner with women professional organizations. If you're covering science, you can go find the women's science organization in your town and partner with them. You know, if you know a big event is coming up, like an election, and there are hot button topics in that election, go now. Find women and diverse sources who want to talk about it now, and cue them up that you're going to be calling them. Bring them into your newsroom, show them around, get them comfortable. You know, oftentimes women have a lot of reasons why they themselves aren't comfortable being sources. And so if you can help with training, with comfort levels, with helping them be aware that you're going
to
call them.
Go to informed opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. So there's just a ton of ways to do this if someone is interested, and it's not rocket science. It's also, right. It's, you know, all the problems in the world. Like, if you think about how the media is such tells us what to think and who to believe and what our world is like, and we can actually do really simple things to entirely change that narrative. It doesn't cost a lot of money. It doesn't take a lot of time. And if everyone did it in every newsroom, we would change the entire way the world thinks. I'm 100% convinced.
Sherry, you and I have talked a little bit about some of the excuses that you often hear from female experts. Would you mind just sharing that with the audience? Because I feel like women are always doubting themselves, even if they are the, you know, the foremost and the literal expert in their field. It's like, well, I don't know if I can go on TV today because of X, Y, or Z.
So first of all, we don't call them excuses.
Yeah. Okay, good to know.
There are legitimate reasons. Women will be held to a higher standard of authority. We know that. We saw Hillary Clinton contest the 2016 election. We saw Anita Hill do what she did. So there are lots of legitimate reasons. Women are busier. If we go on television and we're not, you know, we're having a bad hair day, we're going to hear about that. But what we do at Informed Opinions is, in addition to having this database, and my colleague sitting at the back, Sam, will you put up your hand? There she is. We have postcards that give you strategies for overcoming what we jokingly call as female source reluctance. I know this is a thing, so women do have lots of good reasons to say no, but we are devoted, and we've spent 10 years training and supporting 3,500 women across the country with Informed Opinions. We take them on tours, to your point about demystifying newsrooms. We take them on tours of CBC or TVO, and we'd be happy to bring them on tours of your newsroom, just to give them an experience, get them to meet producers or editors and realize, oh, they don't have horns. They're not all out to make me look bad. So the demystification, the sharing strategies and tools to become more comfortable responding to media interviews, we have a ton of resources on our website that are designed to support women and any men who want to go there to become more comfortable at responding to media interviews, at knowing what to ask before the interview, at knowing how to dress, at thinking shorter, more concise, more concretely, so they're not rambling on in a in a very conceptual way that, you know, is going to end up on the cutting room floor.
All right, I'm going to have to circle back on knowing how to dress, only because there has been some controversy in the past involving a former female prime minister, the only one we've ever had, citing, I think, work that you and your organization was doing in terms of telling women what the best way to present is, because there tends to be this sort of, I want to say, visceral pushback. And I would blame our generation for this a little bit, or the more online, to once you're giving advice out to how to appear, particularly in a television interview, this was in reference, I mean, just cut through the noise here. It was Kim Campbell who was essentially retweeting something that you had said, Sherry, about whether or not you should appear on a television panel in bare arms, or whether or not that's distracting. Because I know for a lot of women, often when you're in the office and you get a call from a producer or from somebody to come on air, you're like, well, I don't know if I can do it because I'm dressed X, Y, or Z. But I've done a lot of media training in the past in terms of training, you know, other executives and the like, whether they're appearing before the Senate or whether they're going to appear on, you know, PowerPlay or whatever. And there is something to be said about there's just a different standard.
So here's what I would say, actually. I think women should dress however they want to. And if you're going on television, it's a visual medium. So if you're wearing dangly earrings that catch the light, or big chunky jewelry, or you're displaying cleavage, people will notice that because it's a visual medium. When I go on television, I want people to listen to what I'm saying. So I dress accordingly. And men go on television wearing the uniform that men have, and maybe it's a t-shirt if they're a rock star, and maybe it's a suit if they're a businessman. But they're generally not dressed in a way that invites the viewer to see them as sexual, or invites the viewer to think of them as something other than an expert. So really, you know, the controversy was I cited research in a blog post that suggested that women with bare arms were taken less seriously. I didn't belabor the research, but Kim Campbell, who we're proud to have as an honorary patron of Informed Opinions, she weighed in on Twitter, and because she's a former prime minister, she got a ton of pushback around that. And I get that. Women have been policed around the way we dress, so I'm not in the business of policing. I'm in the business of encouraging women with informed opinions to be in the media and to be heard and be taken seriously. And my choice around that is not to give people visual distraction that will stop them from hearing what I say.
You know, what it's worth, depending on the set that you're on, sometimes a producer will legit say, don't wear stripes, or don't wear, because it just doesn't go with what the background is. So, I mean, that is worth pointing out. Evie, from your perspective, I wanted to know, just because you're in the world, you're in the depths of social media. Mm-hmm. It just seems odd to me, particularly given the fact that if you're an expert, you likely have a LinkedIn page, or you likely have, you know, a Twitter account or something, or your organization has your email right there. How sourcing has changed, I guess, in the last little bit, and where you expect it to go. So I guess in you know, a couple of years, are we going to be looking for poli-sci experts on TikTok?
Yeah, maybe. Like, right, I have been looking for people on TikTok before. Just like, you know, there's people on TikTok, Gen Z and millennials, and they are trying to, that's their way, they are trying to contribute to the conversation in their kind of medium when it comes to things like politics. So you see it around, you know, teacher strikes, you'll see it around, like, who they're voting for, and, like, that's just the way they think, that's just the way they are. You can't blame them. You can say, yeah, that's a stupid app for dancing, but that's just the way they try to process the things that are going on. Like, I think a big part of it is, again, us being responsible to reach out to that younger generation, right? So maybe they don't want to read, like, just text, or they want to watch video, or they want to see their friends kind of weigh in on the conversation before they do. I think a lot of what I do, as much as I always want to reach out to find, you know, more female sources, more diverse sources, also find that younger audience, because I feel like that's a big thing that I really want to figure out. And through social media, like you said, you can find any source on there now. Like, it's so much easier to find people. And I think back in the day, I don't know how I would be able to do that. But at The Star, I teach like a course called like Creeping 101. It just helps you find like all the experts you need. And I try to make it as, you know, diverse, and you can hear from as many people as you possibly can. So if there's one topic, like we're talking about, I don't know, a certain part of politics, and then you want to hear from three different people from three different backgrounds from, you know, each gender, I'll have that for you because it's so accessible. Like the internet gives you anything. Like it gives you memes, it gives you everything, but it also gives you voices from like everyone, and you can hear every single person. So I think it's even easier in a way to find those people nowadays.
Yeah, Melissa, I was going to ask, like, is there really an excuse nowadays, given the fact that, you know, people do have social media pages and Google does exist, and it is 2020, like, what are some of the, I guess, you know, in doing your work for the Globe, what were some, I don't want to say excuses, but what were some of the reasons or justifications that were being put out there?
My favorite example of this is one of our reporters, Nick Van Pratt. His beat for, you know, the past year, I think, has been largely focused on two companies, Bombardier and SNC-Lavalin. And so
Great Quebec companies.
Yeah. We were doing this challenge to the newsroom about never filing a story that didn't contain at least one female voice. And, you know, he replied and said, you know, before you get angry about this story that I filed without a female voice, like, please look at this. And he had listed, number of top executives
especially,
who work at these companies who are female, zero. Number of analysts who, you know, analyze these companies, and that was, I think, 30 analysts. There was one female, and she was on maternity leave, and she was replaced with a man. So, you know, he had gone through the work of trying to find a female voice that was relevant to his story, but he kept coming up against, you know, these roadblocks. And so I think in that case, like, you know, we don't want to just jam a woman into a story for the sake of having a female voice, and I think he did have legitimate roadblocks there. And I think to your point about, you know, where is the future of sourcing, it's great that journalists are doing all this work, but I think companies also have a role to play here, and like, who are the people that you're putting forward? Who, you know, who are you offering to the media as your spokespeople, and who are you promoting in your company?
I make that case to companies all the time. Mm-hmm. I say journalists, we talk to journalists all the time. They're looking for female sources. If you're positioning your company as competitive in the war on talent, you absolutely need to have female spokespeople, diverse spokespeople, mm-hmm. so that the actual, you know, the people who you want to attract look at your company and say, oh, yes, I might have a chance of advancing at that company because the spokespeople being quoted in the Globe or the Star are look like me.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, in your work, is there a particular outlet or publication that seems to really get it right? Like, is there one model that we should all aspire to as journalists, or is it all a crapshoot?
I wouldn't say it's all a crapshoot, but I would say it's very different based on where you are. It isn't even really about resources, but a lot of the places that we work in the world, there are a lot of cultural barriers as well. There are far less women who work in the industry, or there's definitely less women in higher positions. But I do think there are a lot of big global players that are making a real effort at doing this. Bloomberg News is one of them. They have a huge initiative around putting female sources forward in the economic sector, which is really hard. And they work a lot with training women also to be able to be comfortable to come forward and talk in the media. The BBC has a program called BBC's 50-50 project, where they just count every week they get together, and it's across every one of their platforms and every one of their divisions now, and they just simply do a really very easy daily like tally. So I think there's a whole range of successful endeavors that are out there.
The BBC was a single producer that launched it, Ross Atkins, and he challenged his program producers and researchers and Chase producers to make 50-50 in terms of their guests, and then a whole bunch of other BBC units signed on, including BBC Sports, BBC Politics, BBC Arabic, where you would think that the challenges of recruiting 50% female sources would be extra difficult. And they didn't all reach 50-50, but if you're interested, you can Google BBC 50-50 Challenge and find the report that they produced. And we're going to be launching later this year in Canada a Canada 50-50 Challenge, inviting journalists in Canada who care about these issues, not necessarily to promise or commit that they'll achieve 50-50, but to simply measure, like Ed Yong did, like the journalists at BBC, because what we know is that what gets measured gets done. And so Ed Yong, again, at The Atlantic, when he started, he just kept a spreadsheet off the side of his desk. We have a spreadsheet downloadable from our website that makes it easy for journalists to just check male, female, male, male, female, female, and then the tally happens all on its own. And that feedback is just useful information to say, oh, okay, this is what I did this week. Maybe I can work a little harder next week. And the spreadsheet can be adapted to measure other metrics, other diversity metrics.
And the tracking is a really important thing, because the most important thing is to track actually what you can control, because you can't control who's president, you can't control, mm-hmm. you know, certain news events that happen, and Angelina Jolie is, well, you could not always write about
You could not write about Angelina.
But there are really simple ways,
how did Angelina Jolie get
it was an example that somebody had mentioned in our research somewhere, but okay. They're counting, because the day of the week that you happen to be counting, or the day of the year, or whatever that news cycle is, you know, it could be dominated by factors that are out of your control. And so if you really focus on counting what you can control, you know, I can't control who is president, I can't control, you know, who is the CEO of this company, but I can get a woman that's an expert to comment on the issues that are surrounding that. And you can, in all departments, can also focus on this. We talked to some folks who looked at it in the obituary section of the newspaper, you know, that men are often more featured as famous people who die. And it's, do more men die than women? I mean, it's like, and so you can look in every corner of your coverage, you know, photos, even bylines. You know, we did a lot of work and research around bylines and women reporters versus women opinion writers, all of those.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, and that's what we focus on at The Globe, is the areas we can control. And you mentioned photos, which has been a bright spot at The Globe. We had our data team sort of build this tool that they scan all of the front page newspapers. I'm trying to figure out a way to get them to do the homepage too, but we've started with the front page of the newspaper, and then it classifies who's in the photo. Like, is it a male-dominated photo or a female-dominated photo? And having that tracking has been really crucial for measuring their progress. And we've seen, I think it was 2017, the percentage of male-dominated photos was 69%. Last year, it was down to 61%, and we're on track to do better this year. So having technology help with some of that tracking, mm-hmm, I think is really key, because it doesn't seem like it takes a lot of time, but, you know, as you mentioned, with journalists being so busy, even adding like an extra hour to their day to do tracking can sometimes be a challenge. So I'm hoping technology can help us with that.
One of the interesting aspects is that whenever we're talking about getting more women into a space, whether, you know, that's a boardroom or whether it's being cited as news sources, often those women will end up, you know, predominantly of a certain socioeconomic class, as well as for, you know, racially, and more often than not, they'll end up Caucasian. How do we ensure that the voices that we're going to are also, you know, diverse? How do we ensure that we're getting, you know, Black, Indigenous, and other women of color really into the fore, and that it doesn't just look like a bunch of upper middle class white women, so to say?
For me, I think it's just something that's ingrained in me. I don't feel like the story's complete without all these voices. Like, I personally know we're all on deadline and we all need to figure it out, and thank God for social media, because it really helps me with time. But like, I mean, it depends on the story, of course, but for most often when I have when I am choosing to write the story and I want to do it and I'm passionate, I will include as many voices as I can. And like one of the stories that I wrote for when the Raptors were winning the championship was represented by the Raptors. And Priya and Joe, who are here, who were my editors at the Star, really helped me out. it was about, we actually ran this kind of photo, this workshop talking about how we found all these sources, like the hijabi ballers. Like there was somebody that were, they just played at a mosque in Scarborough. They were literally just like a random drop-in. And I was just like, when I was trying to look for people who are diverse, I had to like, oh, I've never seen like many Muslims featured in sports. Like that's my own thought.
Well, especially hijabi women, right?
Yeah, like, so I never see it. And I was just like, wouldn't that be something that's just like interesting? And I know that happens in Toronto, I just don't know who. So for me, when I was like talking about how we found those people, it was more like explicitly just searching like on Google. I'm like, is there any Muslim like ball leagues? I just want to know if there are, I just want to see. And that's one of the people that we stumbled upon. And I'm talking about me and Sahar, who used to work at the Star, and we wrote it together. And actually for our own practice, just so like we could, I guess, understand more people more, like she's Muslim, she's hijabi, and I was like, I'm gonna go to the mosque and you're gonna go to this Filipino basketball run, all men in Mississauga or whatever. So it's kind of like complete switch, because yeah, I had questions and I was nervous and I felt like so stupid for being so nervous, but I did ask her. I was like, hey, I've never been to a mosque, I have no idea. Like whatever, she's like, just chill, just go in and do it. And I did it and I was like, why am I feeling this way? And even like, and when she went, she like was like, you know, she like they were doing a sermon at the Filipino ball run because it's a Christian ball run, and so for her it's a completely culture switch for both of us. But for us, it made us better journalists in that way because we actually tried to do that, right? Like it took effort. I was nervous. I know she was too. But at the end of it, when it came together, like it's something we're really, really proud of.
So getting out of your comfort zone really helped.
Exactly. Like I will force myself out because I don't want to keep thinking on the same note. I just feel like that's my responsibility as a journalist.
Sherry, I know it's something that you're pretty cognizant of as well, in terms of informed opinions and making sure that your experts are in fact really representative of the general population.
We explicitly track the women that we intake, so it's no cost to be in our database if you have an informed opinion as a woman. And we notice, because many of the experts that we were creating profiles for were academics, and academia is relatively diverse, but our numbers were not reflective of the population. So we became very deliberate about going to women in our network who were from diverse communities and saying, you know, you must know others who are across disciplines and sectors and across the country. Can you introduce us? And so we keep our own spreadsheet tracking, and it's not always possible because not everybody wants to self-identify as living with a disability or being Indigenous or LGBTQ. So, you know, it's not a perfect system, but we're very cognizant of wanting to ensure that our database, given that we're trying to fix the gender piece, is also addressing intersectional issues as well.
And I mean, Deborah, in your work, particularly as it pertains to North America, is that something that you think journalists are cognizant of, or is it just one of those things where it's like, well, I have a story, and I probably should get a woman in there. Maybe I'll just get the first name on Google.
Well, most of the work we do is all, like, personally, the work that InterNews does is all overseas. We do have some work that we do in the U.S., and it is very, very, very community-based, place-based journalism, and it 100% supports diverse voices. That's the kind of work that we support in the U.S., and I would say it's completely not like that, you know. and, you know, some really shocking things that I find, even just when it comes to these kinds of issues. And last year we supported a community radio station in Northern California when the fires were raging all through California. And, you know, 33% of that population is Latino. Some of them are illegal immigrants. And all of the information that came out was in English. So when you get your little alert on the phone that says, you know, warning, there's a fire, like evacuate, it was all in English. And then when it was translated after 2 days later, when they realized, oh, we like are missing this whole population, it was translated off of Google Translate, and it was translated, the messages were translated in error, and people got the wrong information. And there was a whole pile of issues around just how it comes to a point like this when you don't have that diversity of coverage from the beginning, just in all of your regular everyday reporting, and then when a crisis hits and you don't have contacts with all the communities that you cover, and you don't cover in their language, and they don't trust you, and they don't come to you for information. You know, this community went to one local radio station and didn't read any other newspapers, and wouldn't even go to shelters because they were nervous that they would be turned in and sent back. And So it, to me, it just makes
even
sense.
As fires were literally raging upon them.
Yes, literally as they're raging on them, they don't because they don't see themselves in any of these sources, and so they don't trust the information that they're being told, and they're saying this newspaper, who never has reflected me before, is telling me to go to this shelter where I see these people in FEMA outfits that kind of look like ICE to me, the immigration people, so I am not going there because I don't trust anything they ever tell me, so why should I trust this? And so to me, it's just this, it was just such a stark reminder of how we need to do this every day, all of the time, in all of our coverage, so that people trust the information and it reflects who they are.
I think too, beyond the sources in the story are the people who are writing the stories, right? So, I mean, we're challenged right now in the media industry with hiring, but you know, who we
Because we have no money.
Because we have no money.
Yeah. Just point that out there.
But who we seek, you know, freelance opinion pieces from, for example. Like our opinion team has done a lot of work around that. And I think when our public editor did her last count of, you know, the male-female split in the opinion section in particular, they were well ahead in terms of the other sections because they have a bit more, again, control over who they're going out and seeking pieces from. And whether that's, you know, racial diversity, whether that's geographic diversity, like there's all kinds of diversity that they're considering when they ask for freelance pieces.
And I mean, just following up on that, it's interesting to me because I would say from at least being in the talk radio space, it's interesting because your overarching news organization can talk a really good game when it comes to diversity and inclusion, and then who you have as hosts, and then who you have as the people that are actually, you know, going out there and telling people their opinions can often sort of differ. So, I mean, Evie, from your perspective, is there sort of a bit of a disconnect? Or like, are newsrooms and columnists or opinion people at a sort of loggerhead, so to say, or does everybody sort of get it? Because I'm just wondering, is it hard to sell diversity to your newsrooms if a lot of your opinion writers are like, gender parity cabinet, okay. Like, they're all going to menstruate at the same time.
I think it is difficult. I think working, like, it's different, right? So I respect columnists, and they have the right to say what they want to say. I just wish there were more different types of people also writing at the same time, so it wouldn't seem like every across the board it's like similar, like the thoughts are all similar. Like I don't want to read three of the same thing all the time, right? So it's I think that because we're here, we have the freedom of speech, and we are like we should promote that. But I also think that to get in that position to be that person who has that platform, it's really hard. And I think for a lot of younger people, and I myself too, I basically nudged myself. I'm like, hey, can I write a social media column? I love social media, blah, blah, blah. But like it's still, and I use that to try to focus in on other issues that really, you know, like mean a lot to me, which, you know, like it's like, you know, gender disparity and also, you know, being more diverse. So I try to like nudge that in there, but I just feel like there's always going to be sort of a disconnect. I respect the opinions, but I also feel that if there was a way that we could hear more people and they got the same kind of platform too, maybe it would be something that was a little more even or it seemed that way.
You want to get in there, Sherry?
Yeah. Can I just say that when I started Informed Opinions 10 years ago, my explicit focus initially was training women to translate what they knew and cared about into short-form opinion pieces for newspapers or online platforms. So we've now delivered op-ed writing training to more than 3,000 women across the country on our database, women who have written and published op-eds in the Star, in the Globe, elsewhere. There's a badge on their profile on our website. So op-ed page editors who are looking for contributors, who have a track record, who know the form and understand it, that's easy to find on Informed Opinions database. Thousands of women we've trained have had their op-eds published.
Do you ever find that women need to be convinced to write an op-ed?
Yes.
Because yes. Like, nobody wants to hear from me. Like, I'm just a professor at a university who's an expert in my field. Why would they want to hear from me?
Well,
I'm not some opinionated, you know, guy in his car calling into talk radio.
There is that.
Yeah.
There is absolutely that. If a journalist calls a man, I have this now famous story about my husband and I walking across the parking lot of a Catholic church in Montreal on the day the Pope died in 2005, and the TV crew doing streeters said, "The Pope has just died, would you comment?" And I said, "No, I don't think so," and kept walking. And David, who hadn't been to church in 40 years, he said, "Sure." And his comments, which were, "It's a sad day for Catholics everywhere," made the national news. And afterwards, I turned to him and said, "You know, honey, that was a little obvious, and wouldn't it be great if the next pope came up with a progressive policy on birth control that wouldn't trap millions of poor Catholic women around the world in an endless cycle of child-rearing?" And anyway, the point is that women have lots of reasons to say no, and part of the reason informed opinions exists is to overcome those reasons. And one of the things, this is the most powerful thing. There are two things that we've done to do that. One is to say, if you say, "No, I'm not the best person," which may be demonstrably true, even if there were a best person, but I've already said there's not. If you decline the interview, they're not going to find that mythical best person. They're going to go to the guy in the next office, and he's going to say yes.
Instead of the most competent woman, they'll find the loudest man.
Well, you know, they found my husband, and he said, "Sad day for Catholics everywhere." He's a lovely man. He has lots to say. But, you know, what I would have said would have, now they wouldn't have published it or aired it. His comments made the national news. Did I say that piece? They wouldn't have aired my critique of the Pope's policy. But women, most women spend decades of our lives either trying to become pregnant, or trying to avoid becoming pregnant, or dealing with the consequences of having been pregnant, which last forever and change everything.
Hear that, Melissa?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Well, they change our bodies, our brains, our ability to multitask, our perceptions, our priorities. And so this is what I say to women to motivate them. If women's voices are at 28% instead of 50, there are entire swaths of human experience that are not being reflected in the coverage that is influencing and shaping policy discussions and decisions. We took 100 op-eds written by women we had trained that had been published in The Globe and The Star and elsewhere, created a word cloud to see what issues came up, because it's hard to measure an absence. It's hard to predict what would the world look like if women's voices were at 50-50. Then we created a second cohort of op-eds written by men, same period, same publications, deducted the common words. And the word cloud that was left, and you can find this, I think, somewhere on our website, the word cloud that was left was, in some respects, heartbreakingly predictable. So these were issues that were only in the news if women's voices were present. And they included sexual assault, women, girls, violence. This was before the Me Too movement. We did this in 2016. But in addition to those predictable women's issues, there were issues like food and water, evidence and impact, police and racism, dementia and treatment. So the consequences of women's voices not being present at par are vast. We could have avoided the Me Too movement. That's my contention. If women's voices had been at par, we would not be where we are on climate change if women's voices had been at par over the last 20 or 30 years, because women are still socialized to focus on the collective, to think long term. There's lots of research that documents the extent to which men are more willing to take risk for short-term gain. Women consider consequences and long-term pain. Life trains us for that. So, I don't know where the question was. I got in a rant. I'll stop talking now.
I don't know. It was good. Yeah. We only have a few minutes left, so I just wanted to, I guess my last question for the panel would be, if you had like a 30-second elevator pitch with, this person doesn't exist, but the czar of all Canadian news, let's say, as to why it's important to cite female voices, what would you say to them? I'll start with you, Evie, and we'll go that way.
It's pretty simple. I'd just say you're not reflecting the city. You're gonna, I don't know if there's more women in Toronto or but it's basically to me, like, you gotta just serve everybody. I really don't understand why you wouldn't try something like that. It's not even trying something new. I think it's like your job to do that as a journalist.
It's like, right? Going back to basics.
Yeah, like it being a human, like, hi, I see you, you look different. I hope that you feel reflected. And hi, I see you, like, why would you not do that? So for me, it wouldn't be like, oh my God, please do this. It's not a please, like, you just have to do it. Like, I don't understand why diverse people, women aren't getting into the, you know, the front of the paper all the time. I really don't get it. Like, for me, I just feel like you're serving, if you're trying to serve everybody, you gotta figure out how to change it up, because people in our younger generation also aren't looking at that. They're looking at stuff like Six Buzz, and like, they're not going to the traditional routes, right? Because maybe they don't think it serves them. And maybe that's because it's a generation thing, but I personally think it's also like with gender, with race, with everything, it's just they're not reflected. So if you want this to be the future and you want the future to read this, like, you need to figure it out now.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, for you, this mythical czar of news, would that change depending on the newsroom, like the case that you're trying to make, or is there one general case you think you could probably lay out in 30 seconds in an elevator?
I guess instead of trying to lay out the case, because I think Evie did that quite nicely.
Yeah.
What I would say instead is that, you know, it has to come from the highest levels in the newsroom. Like yes, it's great when there's these grassroots initiatives, but unless you have the top people on board.
Like, unless there's an initiative like at the Globe where you're trying to specifically cite.
Yeah, and it needs to be supported by the masthead and by the publisher. You know, we have teams that bake it into their team goals, and that it's part of their performance review process. Like, I think that is all really important for sustaining the momentum.
Does my mythical star get to be a woman?
Yeah, sure.
Then I would just be like, let's go.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's interesting, because, like, do female journalists actually cite more women, or are we just as bad as our male colleagues?
Actually, some of the research shows that it's about 25% more.
Okay.
It's not across the board that way, and sometimes it's shocking when women count themselves, and they're like, oh, I thought I was doing way better than this, but across the board it is true that women will cite more female sources. But then, I mean, joking aside, I would go back to the reversing the statistics to say, like, 75% of the shit I'm hearing and seeing and being exposed to every day comes from the perspectives and viewpoints of men.
And mostly white men.
And mostly white men, and mostly older white men. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be exposed to that all the time. I want something else. And I think everybody wants something else except those men.
And I would say what she said. And I would also say that all of the journalists that I've ever worked with care about democracy, and they see their role as fundamental to the maintenance and promotion of democracy. Journalism is fundamental to democracy. Representation is fundamental to democracy. So you can't actually have effective, responsible journalism if you don't also have effective, responsible representation.
That concludes the actual panel portion of the evening. I'd welcome anyone who does have questions. There's a mic set up right at the back of the room there. If anyone has any questions or comments they'd like to make, a couple of rules. Use the microphone. When this event is being recorded for video and for podcast, you want to make sure your voice is heard. Tell us your name and affiliation. And also make sure there's a question. Don't just go on just to hear your voice. I mean, you have your own voice notes for that. But if anybody does have a question for any of the panelists, or just a general question, then you can do that at the back there.
Take the mic, woman. Don't take a hike. It's a gift, girl.
Someone's going
to amplify your voice, your views. That's news. A privilege.
Hi, my name's Esther Maloney. I run a small grassroots project called Illumin Media Project. I really appreciated the panel. Here's my question, my real question. I really appreciate all the talk about representation, and I would love to hear from anyone on the panel a bit more about, I guess, going beyond representation. What do women's ways of knowing, thinking, being, how do those, and also diverse people, indigenous ways of knowing, how do we actually see that? You know, or have you seen glimpses of how the actual content or the process in the newsroom is being shifted by those differences, which bring that richness that you're all describing?
This doesn't exist yet, but there's this, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the 19th, which is just being started in the States, and it's all based around policy through a female lens, and I'm really interested to see in the kinds of stories that they start producing, because the whole newsroom is being built with, you know, the female perspective in mind. All the staff are female. And I'm curious to see, what kind of content do they produce, and how, what kind of an audience does that attract? I know that's a future, but.
I would say, I mean, I'm not in a newsroom, so I can't speak to what difference it's making, but there's so much policy research and stories that I see on Twitter about issues that, when women's voices are integrated, everything changes. So we know that peace treaties last longer if women are at the table. We know that, I saw this week, that the coronavirus, that our efforts to mitigate the impact of the coronavirus, if women are not part of the discussions that are happening in a country, the ability to address coronavirus is not going to be a fraction as effective, because women are caregivers of kids and elderly people. And so it's inconceivable that integrating women's perspectives in newsrooms, in stories, are not going to bring a different sensibility to the stories and the outcomes and the policies that they inform.
Hi, I'm Marlene Murphy. I work at CBC News. And what I was wondering is if the panel could talk a little bit about whether they feel social media platforms have helped amplify women's voices, or whether that's changed how many voices you hear from in terms of
Yeah, I definitely do. I just think, like I said, social media is a great source, but also, I wrote this a little bit a while ago, but like Tanya Talaga, who is like on social media, like that, in school, I didn't necessarily understand or really learn about like indigenous like issues.
I learned nothing.
Yeah, I don't know, I had to do like grade 10 history, and I think like War of 1812, and I wasn't even really there. I just like tried to get everything right on multiple choice, right? Like I didn't understand what was happening, but like with social media and with her presence and something I had followed before I even joined, like before I was part of like a newsroom or anything, it really opened my eyes to a lot of things. So something like that, like a female voice who's teaching me about this and telling me about these issues, you know, the missing and murdered indigenous women, like hearing all that stuff was so enlightening to me, because it really flipped everything I learned so much during school. I didn't know so much, and that's what really put me on that first path to look through social media, comb through and see who could help me and who can inspire me to find these people. And that's what I also teach some people in the newsroom when we have like a social media training. It's like, make sure, you know, look at, you have so much stuff. Yes, there's so much misinformation, there's so much stuff, but there's just so much in front of you, and in terms of you reaching out to that person or in terms of you learning stuff, like for me, that was really eye-opening for me.
And I would say sort of the flip side to the positive thing is that women who are online, of course, experience a different reality than men, and they are at much greater risk of being trolled, harassed, and of having their information stolen, of being having online violence transition into offline violence and being stalked. So there's a whole other side to when women express their opinions and views online that makes them far more vulnerable than men.
Especially if they're advocating for marginalized populations, especially if they are Black, Indigenous, racialized women, LGBTQ.
Yeah, I would just add from my perspective in terms of finding voices for our show, what was interesting is one day I was like, why are we only hearing from dudes when it comes to international security or international relations? And then we went to this professor, Stephanie Carvin. She's based out of Carleton in Ottawa. And you know, we went to her for a few times, and she was away at a conference. And I was like, can you recommend anybody else? And she's like, yeah, here are a few colleagues. And she's like, oh, and by the way, here are several women I follow on Twitter in my same field that are incredibly knowledgeable, and I just had my producer reach out to them. So in that respect, I find, and Evie, you probably agree, mm-hmm. social media has just opened up an entire, mm-hmm. you know, portal almost, yeah, like this sure. dimension that didn't exist to female experts that we definitely wouldn't have access to otherwise. Mm-hmm.
Hi there, my name is Sonia. I am a student at the University of Guelph Humber, and I'm also interning at the Canadian Women's Foundation. So my question is for Sherry. I know you mentioned like how women dress within the media, you know, with being very conservative. But my question for you is, how does that basically go against the whole idea of victim blaming when it comes to the Me Too movement? Because I feel like with the Me Too movement, a lot of people get blamed for victim blaming. And so as a woman in the media, how do you feel like you're kind of perpetuating that stereotype?
Yeah, so I started my response earlier saying, I think women should get to dress however they want. And my choice when I'm on television is to dress to be heard. So that informs how I choose. And, you know, women should, of course, never be victim blamed, or assumptions should never be made about women based on how they dress. And I wait and yearn for the world to be like that. And, you know, I know that when a woman appears on television and she's wearing a headscarf, we all make assumptions about her that may not be remotely grounded in reality. So I lament the world we live in, and, you know, I'm advocating for change in the ways that we can, and I don't know if that answered your question, but...
At the Globe, we have had people come in and do workshops. You know, we had an Indigenous man come in and talk about Indigenous coverage in the media, and we have a Slack channel where people can go in and just say, like, hey, is anyone free to take a look at this? I just want to make sure, you know, I'm characterizing it correctly, and because it's hard to put it all on like one person in the newsroom, like to say, like, you represent all Indigenous people, please read this. So we try to widen that group to whoever feels comfortable, and I think having people from the outside the newsroom come in and do those workshops is just so important.
My name is Abhya, and I'm an intern at The Star. Today we talked about intersectionality and visible minorities and how they're represented in the media. But my question was, have you actually seen an increase in the number of women from visible minorities in the newsroom? Because I feel like that would also play a role in how much like women from these minorities are represented in the media as well.
Do you want to? I mean, go for it.
I will say at global, the newsroom itself is incredibly diverse, and there are in fact a lot of women that are represented from, you know, various ethnic, religious, racial, minority backgrounds there. I think the difference though then becomes as to who is presented on camera or in front of a mic and who is doing the work behind the scenes. And I think in terms of who gets more, I guess, priority placement, if you want to put it that way, we definitely do have quite a ways to go. I will say that in Vancouver, for example, CKNW, which is 640 sister station out there as part of Global News Talk Radio stream, they just hired Simi Sarah. She's due, you know, middays. She's a Punjabi woman who's been in the mix for quite some time. And I don't know, for me, it's just nice to have someone else who looks like me, mm-hmm. who is probably subject to the same kind of hate mail that I get, that is nice to sort of commiserate with. And I would just say, at least from Global's perspective, you know, it wasn't an accident that I ended up as co-host of the morning show. It was something that they realized that in terms of the GTA and in terms of their listenership, it was like, there are a lot of people that look like Supriya. Maybe we should have Supriya on to sort of, you know, reflect those opinions and those views.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think we have, across the board, we have a long way to go, of course, for women of visible minorities, for sure. And one thing I always say is, like, something that I kind of went through is just try to find a mentor if you can, if there's someone, like you're saying, like, there's someone you can talk to and just be like, girl, I need to talk. Like, what's happening? And try to find that. There are sources and resources, and I'd be more than happy to share, like, my contact to help anyone else to see if there's anything else, like, any other, like, people we can recommend or stuff. But there's many groups. There's, like, you know, the Canadian Journalists of Color, and there are a lot of people who are really willing to help. It's trying to find those communities and try to build it up in a positive way. Of course, there's stuff to criticize, and of course, I mean, we feel it. But, like, I just feel like right now what we can do is try to build each other up, and I'm totally open to sharing my contact with anyone to help that.
Do you have a follow-up? It looked like you had a follow-up. You're okay?
No.
Okay.
All right. Hi, my name's Deborah. I work for a place called ICES, which is a health research organization, so I'm coming at it from a bit of a different side. I'm the person who wants to get our experts in front of journalists.
Is that pronounced ISIS, and you just didn't pronounce it ISIS?
It used to be pronounced. Your ISIS is good, so.
Okay.
We have tons of resources.
Oh, I'm going to go.
uninformedopinions.org to motivate and address and incentivize and give tools to address those experiences. We also we have an active presence on Twitter. When one of the people in our database is in the media being quoted or writing an op-ed, we retweet and promote that. And similarly, if one of them is getting attacked and trolled, the sisterhood is there for her. So we're happy to respond. And yeah, I'd love to talk to you more about how we could support what you're trying to do.
Yeah, and I would just say it's not so much like building a thicker skin, but I would, this may not be, okay, I'm just going to say it. I would just use the acronym DGAF, like don't give an F about it, because I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of the people that are attacking the female experts are like dudes living in their mom's basement, right? Like, so it's not coming from a peer group where it's an equal in their respective expertise that is giving actual substantive critique. It's just like, your eyeshadow was whatever, and you're just and so there does have to be a certain level of, and I appreciate from your perspective, you don't just want to tell people grow a thicker skin, but there is an aspect of there are a lot of trolls online and a lot of very unhappy, honestly, people that are just looking to take out their unhappiness on women that are successful.
Ezra Pound, American poet, said, pay no attention to the criticism of men sick who have not themselves written a notable work. So we mention that often. Mm.
Sounds like your ball.
Yeah, okay. I mean, like, write, get experience any way that you can. You know, we don't say, like, oh, you need to go to journalism school, like, in university. That is not a criteria. In fact, we've actually seen, like, a lot, through the summer program anyways, a lot of people who pursue some other kind of degree in university and do their school newspaper or, like, you know, write for their local newspaper or local blog or whatever organization, actually have a lot more experience because, you know, they're really seeking it out and in a different way than journalism students do, which is weird. But so I would say the most important thing is just going out and doing the work. In whatever form that takes.
And I would just slightly add to that is if you are going to do that and you think you're like a politics writer, but there's something that opens up that's on, I don't know, the agricultural beat or what's happening, like don't pick and choose. Like don't sell yourself short almost, right? Like don't pigeonhole yourself at an early stage of your career, particularly as young as high school.
Yeah, and we see a lot of people who really love sports. And so, you know, their entire portfolio, all their clippings are sports, which is fine. But at a newspaper, you know, you're going to be thrown into a lot of different assignments. So something that shows that, you know, you're not afraid to cover many different topics, that really helps, yeah.
And I think, too, while it's fewer and fewer jobs, somehow it's easier to build a portfolio now because you have all the capacity to do it on your own and you can blog and podcast and create your own portfolio and show your writing in really rich ways that when I was coming up in journalism, I didn't have that option to do, right? I just had to get clips. Somebody had to publish me. Yeah. So write, like she said, or record or whatever you're interested in.
That's a really good point, too. Like I would add, we get, you know, 90% of the people who want to work at the Globe want to be reporters. And, you know, we don't have a lot of reporting jobs. We've got, not that we have a lot of jobs, period, but, you know, the way that we structure the summer program is half of them are reporters, half of them are sort of on the programming audience team where, you know, you're writing newsletters and you're running the homepage and you're running our social media accounts, and then we have someone on the photo design team. So, you know, there is a lot less competition, I would say, for non-reporter jobs. Mm. And that doesn't mean that when you do those jobs, you can't also do some reporting as well. So, yeah.
Hi, my name's Kathleen, and like Deborah, I work at a research institute called CIFAR. We're a national research institute. We have a lot of academics who are experts in their fields. And I had an interesting issue today come up for International Women's Day. A number of our academics were profiled as top 10 women in their field. One of them does not identify with a gender. And I'm wondering, it put a thought into my head, what do you think we'll have a future where, just like this, there are I listened very intently to you saying, if we don't measure it, we can't address it. We don't know what's happening. Do you think we'll get to a point where we do the same with people from LGBTQ communities, people who do not identify with the gender, and we can look at a future where it's not a binary polarity of who's getting coverage, who's getting voice?
I will start by saying that the gender gap tracker, which measures gender in a binary way and does it automatically with algorithms and artificial intelligence, there isn't a way currently for us easily to expand that based on the tech tools available, and because they is used for now a number of different things, individuals as well as organizations or groups of people. So it is a harder thing to measure in that respect. And in our database, as I mentioned, we invite people to self-identify as one in whatever ways they want, and some of them choose to and some of them choose not to. And so I think in one respect, we will need to live in a much more open and tolerant society where the level of acceptance is much higher than it is now for people to self-identify in the first place, and then we need more sophisticated tools to make it easy to measure. If a story is not referencing gender identity, then it may not be obvious. So you might have an expert quoted, but if it may not be clear that they identify differently in the story if the story is about financial affairs or something else.
Thank you. Is that the last one? That's perfect, because we're basically out of time. So that worked out quite nicely. I would now like to welcome to the podium Madame President and Executive Director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, Natalie Turvey.
Thank you. Has been an important and timely hour of discussion. The Canadian Journalism Foundation is celebrating a milestone anniversary this year, 30 years of supporting better journalism in Canada. And our founding motto, as journalism goes, so goes democracy, feels more relevant today than ever before in these challenging and unpredictable times where the media faces sometimes unprecedented hostility, especially in the US, and a crisis in trust. And to echo some of Evie's comments, a big part of that crisis in trust is a product of people not seeing themselves represented in the stories and the media they consume. And rebuilding that trust can only start by including the voices of all Canadians in our news. And if people see themselves and their news reflected through that lens, that becomes news worth paying for. So we can tell that mythical czar that a diversity of sources is good for journalism, it's good for the business model, and it's vital to the health of our democracy. So on behalf of the CJF, I want to thank our panel for sharing. They are all champions, and they are part of the solution for sharing their insights and strategies for increasing that trust through a diversity of sources that represent our audiences. Thank you for being here. I would also like to thank our always stellar moderator, Supriya Dwivedi. She's a good friend of the CJF, and I can tell you firsthand she cares deeply and passionately about these issues and quality journalism, and we want to thank her for the work she put in to making this a conversation we can all benefit from. Thank you, Supriya. Kathy, this is our sixth annual event with TD, and I want to thank our CJF director, Paolo Pasquini, and TD for their leadership in supporting a healthy and vibrant press in Canada, and for giving us a stage each year to tackle some of the most pressing issues facing the media. Our first event together celebrated International Women's Day with a look at the challenges and successes of women who hold top spots in media. We've since explored a number of issues, from how the media is changing around diversity and coverage of LGBTQ issues to the stories behind some of today's most powerful investigative reporting, like Unfounded, as well as the mental health repercussions for journalists covering crisis and conflict. So we're grateful to TD for their support, and this view never gets old. I am the only thing standing between you and a cocktail reception, but we have a few more events yet to come, and we hope to see you there, and we hope hope you'll spread the word. On October 21st, we head to Ottawa to explore covering the chaos of U.S. politics and the presidential election with CNN's Washington Bureau Chief Sam Feist. And on April 30th in Toronto, we confront why seeing isn't always believing with a deep dive into the threat of deep fake video, present and future, and its role in spreading misinformation. And on June 10th, we are celebrating our 30 years at the CJF Annual Awards Gala in Toronto, hosted by National Comedy Treasure Rick Mercer, and with a tribute to the venerable Anna Maria Tremonti for her commitment to excellence in journalism and her trailblazing career over three decades in Canada. Finally, my thanks to all of you for being here tonight and for supporting the work of the CJF. We hope to see you again soon. I would like you to stay, invite you to stay with us, meet our panel, and continue the conversation at the cocktail reception. Thank you.